One organization fostering such initiatives on the international level is the International Labour Organization, the oldest specialized agency of the United Nations Organization. In the following part of these considerations, I intend to return in greater detail to these important questions, recalling at least the basic elements of the Church's teaching on the matter. I must, however, first touch on a very important field of questions, in which her teaching has taken shape, in this latest period, the one marked, and in a sense symbolized by the publication of the encyclical Rerum Novarum. Throughout this period, which is by no means yet over, the issue of work has of course been posed on the basis of the great conflict that in the age of, and together with, industrial development emerged between, capital, and, labor, that is to say between the small but highly influential group of entrepreneurs, owners, or holders of the means of production, and the broader multitude of people, who lacked these means, and who shared in the process of production solely by their labor. The conflict originated in the fact that the workers put their powers at the disposal of the entrepreneurs, and these, following the principle of maximum profit, try to establish the lowest possible wages for the work done by the employees. In addition, there were other elements of exploitation connected with the lack of safety at work and of safeguards regarding the health and living conditions of the workers and their families. This conflict, interpreted by some as a socio-economic class conflict, found expression in the ideological conflict between liberalism, understood as the ideology of capitalism, and Marxism, understood as the ideology of scientific socialism and communism, which professes to act as the spokesman for the working class and the worldwide proletariat. Thus the real conflict between labor and capital was transformed into a systematic class struggle, conducted not only by ideological means, but also, and chiefly by political means. We are familiar with the history of this conflict, and with the demands of both sides. The Marxist program, based on the philosophy of Marx and Engels, sees in class struggle the only way to eliminate class injustices in society and to eliminate the classes themselves. Putting this program into practice presupposes the collectivization of the means of production, so that, through the transfer of these means from private hands to the collectivity, human labor will be preserved from exploitation. This is the goal of the struggle carried on by political as well as ideological means. In accordance with the principle of the dictatorship of the proletariat, the groups that as political parties follow the guidance of Marxist ideology aim, by the use of various kinds of influence, including revolutionary pressure, to win a monopoly of power in each society in order to introduce the collectivist system into it by eliminating private ownership of the means of production. According to the principal ideologists and leaders of this broad international movement, the purpose of this program of action is to achieve the social revolution, and to introduce socialism, and, finally, the communist system throughout the world. As we touch on this extremely important field of issues, which constitute not only a theory, but a whole fabric of socio-economic, political, and international life in our age, we cannot go into the details. Nor is this necessary, for they are known both from the vast literature on the subject and by experience. Instead, we must leave the context of these issues and go back to the fundamental issue of human work, which is the main subject of the considerations in this document. It is clear, indeed, that this issue, which is of such importance for man, it constitutes one of the fundamental dimensions of his earthly existence, and of his vocation, can also be explained only by taking into account the full context of the contemporary situation. 12. The priority of labor. The structure of the present day's situation is deeply marked by many conflicts caused by man, and the technological means produced by human work play a primary role in it. We should also consider here the prospect of worldwide catastrophe, in the case of a nuclear war, which would have almost unimaginable possibilities of destruction. In view of this situation, we must first of all recall a principle that has always been taught by the Church, the principle OT, the priority of labor over capital. This principle directly concerns the process of production. In this process, labor is always a primary efficient cause, while capital, the whole collection of means of production, remains a mere instrument or instrumental cause. This principle is an evident truth that emerges from the whole of man's historical experience. When we read in the first chapter of the Bible that man is to subdue the earth, we know that these words refer to all the resources contained in the visible world, and placed at man's disposal. However, these resources can serve man only through work. From the beginning there is also linked with work the question of ownership, for the only means that man has for causing the resources hidden in nature to serve himself and others is his work. And to be able through his work to make these resources bear fruit, man takes over ownership of small parts of the various riches of nature, those beneath the ground, those in the sea, on land, or in space. He takes all these things over by making them his workbench. He takes them over through work and for work. The same principle applies in the successive phases of this process, in which the first phase always remains the relationship of man with the resources and riches of nature, the whole of the effort to acquire knowledge with the aim of discovering these riches, and specifying the various ways in which they can be used by man. And for man teaches us that everything that comes from man throughout the whole process of economic production, whether labor, or the whole collection of means of production, and the technology connected with these means, meaning the capability to use them in work, presupposes these riches and resources of the visible world, riches and resources that man finds, and does not create. In a sense, man finds them already prepared, ready for him to discover them, and to use them correctly in the productive process. In every phase of the development of his work, man comes up against the leading role of the gift made by nature, that is to say, in the final analysis, by the Creator. At the beginning of man's work is the mystery of creation. This affirmation, already indicated as my starting point, is the guiding thread of this document, and will be further developed in the last part of these reflections. Further consideration of this question should confirm our conviction of the priority of human labor over what in the course of time we have grown accustomed to calling capital, since the concept of capital includes not only the natural resources placed at man's disposal, but also the whole collection of means by which man appropriates natural resources and transforms them in accordance with his needs, and thus in a sense humanizes them. It must immediately be noted that all these means are the result of the historical heritage of human labor. All the means of production, from the most primitive to the ultra-modern ones, it is man that has gradually developed them, man's experience and intellect. In this way there have appeared not only the simplest instruments for cultivating the earth, but also, through adequate progress in science and technology, the more modern and complex ones, machines, factories, laboratories, and computers. Thus everything that is at the service of work, everything that in the present state of technology constitutes its ever more highly perfected instrument, is the result of work. This gigantic and powerful instrument, the whole collection of means of production, that in a sense are considered synonymous with capital, is the result of work, and bears the signs of human labor. At the present stage of technological advance, when man, who is the subject of work, wishes to make use of this collection of modern instruments, the means of production, he must first assimilate cognitively the result of the work of the people who invented those instruments, who planned them, built them, and perfected them, and who continued to do so. Capacity for work, that is to say, for sharing efficiently in the modern production process, demands greater and greater preparation, and, before all else, proper training. Obviously, it remains clear that every human being sharing in the production process, even if he or she is only doing the kind of work for which no special training or qualifications are required, is the real efficient subject in this production process, while the whole collection of instruments, no matter how perfect they may be in themselves, are only a mere instrument subordinate to human labor. This truth, which is part of the abiding heritage of the Church's teaching, must always be emphasized with reference to the question of the labor system, and with regard to the whole socio-economic system. We must emphasize and give prominence to the primacy of man in the production process, the primacy of man over things, Everything contained in the concept of capital in the strict sense is only a collection of things. Man, as the subject of work, and independently of the work that he does, man alone is a person. This truth has important and decisive consequences. 13. Economism and Materialism. In the light of the above truth, we see clearly, first of all, that capital cannot be separated from labor. In no way can labor be opposed to capital or capital to labor, and still less can the actual people behind these concepts be opposed to each other. As will be explained later, a labor system can be right, in the sense of being in conformity with the very essence of the issue, and in the sense of being intrinsically true, and also morally legitimate, if in its very basis it overcomes the opposition between labor and capital through an effort at being shaped in accordance with the principle put forward above, the principle of the substantial and real priority of labor, of the subjectivity of human labor, and its effective participation in the whole production process, independently of the nature of the services provided by the worker. Opposition between labor and capital does not spring from the structure of the production process, or from the structure of the economic process. In general, the latter process demonstrates that labor, and what we are accustomed to call capital, are intermingled. It shows that they are inseparably linked. Working at any workbench, whether a relatively primitive or an ultra-modern one, a man can easily see that through his work he enters into two inheritances: the inheritance of what is given to the whole of humanity in the resources of nature, and the inheritance of what others have already developed on the basis of those resources, primarily by developing technology, that is to say, by producing a whole collection of increasingly perfect instruments for work. In working, man also enters into the labor of others. 21. Guided both by our intelligence and by the faith that draws light from the Word of God, we have no difficulty in accepting this image of the sphere and process of man's labor. It is a consistent image, one that is humanistic as well as theological. In it, man is the master of the creatures placed at his disposal in the visible world. If some dependence is discovered in the work process, it is dependence on the giver of all the resources of creation, and also on other human beings, those to whose work and initiative we owe the perfected and increased possibilities of our own work. All that we can say of everything in the production process, which constitutes a whole collection of things, the instruments, the capital, is that it conditions man's work. We cannot assert that it constitutes, as it were, an impersonal subject, putting man and man's work into a position of dependence. This consistent image, in which the principle of the primacy of person over things is strictly preserved, was broken up in human thought, sometimes after a long period of incubation in practical living. The break occurred in such a way that labor was separated from capital and set in opposition to it, and capital was set in opposition to labor, as though they were two impersonal forces, two production factors juxtaposed in the same economistic perspective. This way of stating the issue contained a fundamental error, what we can call the error of economism, that of considering human labor solely according to its economic purpose. This fundamental error of thought can and must be called an error of materialism, in that economism directly or indirectly includes a conviction of the primacy and superiority of the material, and directly or indirectly places the spiritual and the personal man's activity, moral values, and such matters, in a position of subordination to material reality. This is still not theoretical materialism in the full sense of the term, but it is certainly practical materialism, a materialism judged capable of satisfying man's needs, not so much on the grounds of premises derived from materialist theory, as on the grounds of a particular way of evaluating things, and so on the grounds of a certain hierarchy of goods based on the greater immediate attractiveness of what is material. The error of thinking in the categories of economism went hand in hand with the formation of a materialist philosophy, as this philosophy developed from the most elementary and common phase, also called common materialism, because it professes to reduce spiritual reality to a superfluous phenomenon, to the phase of what is called dialectical materialism. However, Within the framework of the present consideration, it seems that economism had a decisive importance for the fundamental issue of human work, in particular for the separation of labor and capital, and for setting them up in opposition, as two production factors viewed in the above-mentioned economistic perspective, and it seems that economism influenced this non-humanistic way of stating the issue before the materialist philosophical system did. Nevertheless, it is obvious that materialism, including its dialectical form, is incapable of providing sufficient and definitive bases for thinking about human work, in order that the primacy of man over the capital instrument, the primacy of the person over things, may find in it adequate and irrefutable confirmation and support. In dialectical materialism too, man is not first and foremost the subject of work and the efficient cause of the production process, but continues to be understood and treated in dependence on what is material as a kind of resultant of the economic or production relations prevailing at a given period. Obviously, the antinomy between labor and capital under consideration here, the antinomy in which labor was separated from capital and set up in opposition to it, in a certain sense on the ontic level, as if it were just an element, like any other in the economic process, did not originate merely in the philosophy and economic theories of the 18th century. Rather, it originated in the whole of the economic and social practice of that time, the time of the birth and rapid development of industrialization, in which what was mainly seen was the possibility of vastly increasing material wealth, means, while the end, that is to say, man, who should be served by the means, was ignored. It was this practical error that struck a blow first and foremost against human labor, against the working man, and caused the ethically just social reaction already spoken of above, the same error which is now part of history, and which was connected with the period of primitive capitalism and liberalism, can nevertheless be repeated in other circumstances of time and place, if people's thinking starts from the same theoretical or practical premises. The only chance there seems to be for radically overcoming this error is through adequate changes both in theory and in practice, changes in line with a definite conviction of the primacy of the person over things, and of human labor over capital, as a whole collection of means of production. 14. Work and ownership. The historical process briefly presented here has certainly gone beyond its initial phase, but it is still taking place, and indeed is spreading in the relationships between nations and continents. It needs to be specified further from another point of view. It is obvious that, when we speak of opposition between labor and capital, we are not dealing only with abstract concepts or impersonal forces operating in economic production. Behind both concepts there are people, living, actual people. On the one side are those who do the work without being the owners of the means of production, and on the other side those who act as entrepreneurs and who own these means or represent the owners. Thus the issue of ownership or property enters from the beginning into the whole of this difficult historical process. The encyclical Rerum Novarum, which has the social question as its theme, stresses this issue also, recalling and confirming the Church's teaching on ownership, on the right to private property even when it is a question of the means of production. The encyclical Moderat Magistra did the same. The above principle, as it was then stated, and as it is still taught by the Church, diverges radically from the program of collectivism, as proclaimed by Marxism, and put into practice in various countries in the decades following the time of Leo XIII's encyclical. At the same time, it differs from the program of capitalism practiced by liberalism and by the political systems inspired by it. In the latter case, the difference consists in the way the right to ownership or property is understood. Christian tradition has never upheld this right as absolute and untouchable. On the contrary, it has always understood this right within the broader context of the right common to all to use the goods of the whole of creation. The right to private property is subordinated to the right to common use, to the fact that goods are meant for everyone. Furthermore, in the Church's teaching, ownership has never been understood in a way that could constitute grounds for social conflict in labor, As mentioned above, property is acquired first of all through work in order that it may serve work. This concerns in a special way ownership of the means of production, isolating these means as a separate property in order to set it up in the form of capital, in opposition to labor, and even to practice exploitation of labor is contrary to the very nature of these means and their possession. They cannot be possessed against labor, they cannot even be possessed for possession's sake, because the only legitimate title to their possession, whether in the form of private ownership, or in the form of public or collective ownership, is that they should serve labor, and thus, by serving labor, that they should make possible the achievement of the first principle of this order, namely, the universal destination of goods, and the right to common use of them. From this point of view, therefore, in consideration of human labor, and of common access to the goods meant for man, one cannot exclude the socialization, in suitable conditions, of certain means of production. In the course of the decades since the publication of the encyclical Rerum Novarum, the Church's teaching has always recalled all these principles, going back to the arguments formulated in a much older tradition. For example, the well-known arguments of the Summa Theologiae of St. Thomas Aquinas 22. In the present document, which has human work as its main theme, it is right to confirm all the effort with which the Church's teaching has striven and continues to strive always to ensure the priority of work and, thereby, man's character as a subject in social life and, especially, in the dynamic structure of the whole economic process. From this point of view, the position of rigid capitalism continues to remain unacceptable, namely the position that defends the exclusive right to private ownership of the means of production as an untouchable dogma of economic life. The principle of respect for work demands that this right should undergo a constructive revision, both in theory and in practice, if it is true that capital, as the whole of the means of production, is at the same time the product of the work of generations. It is equally true that capital is being unceasingly created through the work done with the help of all these means of production, and these means can be seen as a great workbench at which the present generation of workers is working day after day. Obviously, we are dealing here with different kinds of work, not only so-called manual labor, but also the many forms of intellectual work, including white-collar work and management. In the light of the above, the many proposals put forward by experts in Catholic social teaching and by the highest magisterium of the Church take on special significance. 23. Proposals for joint ownership of the means of work, sharing by the workers in the management and/or profits of businesses, so-called shareholding by labor, etc. Whether these various proposals can or cannot be applied concretely, it is clear that recognition of the proper position of labor and the worker in the production process demands various adaptations. In the sphere of the right to ownership of the means of production, this is so not only in view of older situations, but also, first and foremost, in view of the whole of the situation and the problems in the second half of the present century with regard to the so-called Third World and the various new independent countries that have arisen, especially in Africa, but elsewhere as well, in place of the colonial territories of the past. Therefore, while the position of rigid capitalism must undergo continual revision in order to be reformed from the point of view of human rights, both human rights in the widest sense and those linked with man's work, it must be stated that, from the same point of view, these many deeply desired reforms cannot be achieved by an a priori elimination of private ownership of the means of production. For it must be noted that merely taking these means of production capital out of the hands of their private owners is not enough to ensure their satisfactory socialization. They cease to be the property of a certain social group, namely the private owners, and become the property of organized society, coming under the administration and direct control of another group of people, namely those who, though not owning them, from the fact of exercising power in society manage them on the level of the whole national or the local economy. This group in authority may carry out its task satisfactorily from the point of view of the priority of labor, but it may also carry it out badly by claiming for itself a monopoly of the administration and disposal of the means of production, and not refraining even from offending basic human rights, thus merely converting the means of production into state property in the collectivist system is by no means equivalent to socializing that property. We can speak of socializing only when the subject character of society is ensured, that is to say, when on the basis of his work each person is fully entitled to consider himself a part owner of the great work bench at which he is working with everyone else. A way towards that goal could be found by associating labor with the ownership of capital, as far as possible, and by producing a wide range of intermediate bodies with economic, social and cultural purposes. They would be bodies enjoying real autonomy with regard to the public powers, pursuing their specific aims in honest collaboration with each other, and in subordination to the demands of the common good, and they would be living communities both in form and in substance. In the sense that the members of each body would be looked upon and treated as persons, and encouraged to take an active part in the life of the body. 24.15. The personalist argument. Thus, the principle of the priority of labor over capital is a postulate of the order of social morality. It has key importance both in the system built on the principle of private ownership of the means of production, and also in the system in which private ownership of these means has been limited even in a radical way. Labor is in a sense inseparable from capital. In no way does it accept the antinomy, that is to say, the separation and opposition with regard to the means of production, that has weighed upon human life in recent centuries, as a result of merely economic premises. When man works, using all the means of production, he also wishes the fruit of this work to be used by himself and others, and he wishes to be able to take part in the very work process as a sharer in responsibility and creativity at the workbench to which he applies himself. From this spring certain specific rights of workers, corresponding to the obligation of work. They will be discussed later, but here it must be emphasized, in general terms, that the person who works desires not only to remuneration for his work, he also wishes that, within the production process, provision be made for him to be able to know that in his work, even on something that is owned in common, he is working for himself. This awareness is extinguished within him in a system of excessive bureaucratic centralization, which makes the worker feel that he is just a cog in a huge machine moved from above, that he is for more reasons than one a mere production instrument rather than a true subject of work with an initiative of his own. The Church's teaching has always expressed the strong and deep conviction that man's work concerns not only the economy, but also, and especially, personal values. The economic system itself and the production process benefit precisely when these personal values are fully respected. In the mind of St. Thomas Aquinas 25, this is the principal reason in favor of private ownership of the means of production. While we accept that for certain well-founded reasons exceptions can be made to the principle of private ownership in our own time, we even see that the system of socialized ownership has been introduced. Nevertheless, the personalist argument still holds good both on the level of principles and on the practical level. If it is to be rational and fruitful, any socialization of the means of production must take this argument into consideration. Every effort must be made to ensure that in this kind of system also the human person can preserve his awareness of working for himself. If this is not done, incalculable damage is inevitably done throughout the economic process, not only economic damage, but first and foremost damage to man. 4. Rights of workers. 16. Within the broad context of human rights. While work, in all its many senses, is an obligation, that is to say a duty, it is also a source of rights on the part of the worker. These rights must be examined in the broad context of human rights, as a whole, which are connatural with man, and many of which are proclaimed by various international organizations, and increasingly guaranteed by the individual states for their citizens' respect, for this broad range of human rights constitutes the fundamental condition for peace in the modern world, peace both within individual countries and societies, and in international relations, as the Church's Magisterium has several times noted, especially since the encyclical Pacem in Terris. The human rights that flow from work are part of the broader context of those fundamental rights of the person. However, within this context they have a specific character corresponding to the specific nature of human work. As outlined above, it is in keeping with this character that we must view them. Work is, as has been said, an obligation, that is to say, a duty, on the part of man. This is true in all the many meanings of the word. Man must work, both because the Creator has commanded it, and because of his own humanity, which requires work in order to be maintained and developed. Man must work out of regard for others, especially his own family, but also for the society he belongs to, the country of which he is a child, and the whole human family of which he is a member, since he is the heir to the work of generations, and at the same time a sharer in building the future of those who will come after him in the succession of history. All this constitutes the moral obligation of work, understood in its wide sense. When we have to consider the moral rights corresponding to this obligation of every person with regard to work, we must always keep before our eyes the whole vast range of points of reference in which the labor of every working subject is manifested. For when we speak of the obligation of work, and of the rights of the worker that correspond to this obligation, we think in the first place of the relationship between the employer, direct or indirect, and the worker. The distinction between the direct and the indirect employer is seen to be very important when one considers both the way in which labor is actually organized and the possibility of the formation of just or unjust relationships in the field of labor. Since the direct employer is the person or institution with whom the worker enters directly into a work contract in accordance with definite conditions, we must understand as the indirect employer many different factors, other than the direct employer, that exercise a determining influence on the shaping both of the work contract and, consequently, of just or unjust relationships in the field of human labor. 17. Direct and indirect employer. The concept of indirect employer includes both persons and institutions of various kinds, and also collective labor contracts and the principles of conduct which are laid down by these persons and institutions, and which determine the whole socio-economic system, or are its result. The concept of indirect employer thus refers to many different elements. The responsibility of the indirect employer differs from that of the direct employer. The term itself indicates that the responsibility is less direct, but it remains a true responsibility. The indirect employer substantially determines one or other facet of the labor relationship, thus conditioning the conduct of the direct employer. When the latter determines in concrete terms the actual work contract and labor relations, this is not to absolve the direct employer from his own responsibility, but only to draw attention to the whole network of influences that condition his conduct. When it is a question of establishing an ethically correct labor policy, all these influences must be kept in mind. A policy is correct when the objective rights of the worker are fully respected. The concept of indirect employer is applicable to every society, and in the first place to the state, for it is the state that must conduct a just labor policy. However, it is common knowledge that in the present system of economic relations in the world there are numerous links between individual states, links that find expression, for instance, in the import and export process, that is to say, in the mutual exchange of economic goods, whether raw materials, semi-manufactured goods, or finished industrial products. These links also create mutual dependence, and, as a result, it would be difficult to speak, in the case of any state, even the economically most powerful, of complete self-sufficiency or autarky. Such a system of mutual dependence is in itself normal. However, it can easily become an occasion for various forms of exploitation or injustice, and, as a result, influence the labor policy of individual states, and finally it can influence the individual worker, who is the proper subject of labor. for instance the highly industrialized countries, and even more the businesses, that direct on a large scale the means of industrial production and the companies referred to as multinational or transnational, fix the highest possible prices for their products, while trying at the same time to fix the lowest possible prices for raw materials or semi-manufactured goods. This is one of the causes of an ever-increasing disproportion between national incomes. The gap between most of the richest countries and the poorest ones is not diminishing or being stabilized, but is increasing more and more, to the detriment, obviously, of the poorer countries. Evidently, this must have an effect on local labor policy and on the workers' situation in the economically disadvantaged societies. Finding himself in a system thus conditioned, the direct employer fixes working conditions below the objective requirements of the workers, especially if he himself wishes to obtain the highest possible profits from the business which he runs, or from the businesses which he runs, in the case of a situation of socialized ownership of the means of production. It is easy to see that this framework of forms of dependence linked with the concept of the indirect employer is enormously extensive and complicated. It is determined, in a sense, by all the elements that are decisive for economic life within a given society and state, but also by much wider links and forms of dependence. The attainment of the workers' rights cannot, however, be doomed to be merely a result of economic systems which on a larger or smaller scale are guided chiefly by the criterion of maximum profit. On the contrary, it is respect for the objective rights of the worker, every kind of worker, manual or intellectual, industrial or agricultural, etc., that must constitute the adequate and fundamental criterion for shaping the whole economy, both on the level of the individual society and state, and within the whole of the world economic policy, and of the systems of international relationships that derive from it. Influence in this direction should be exercised by all the international organizations whose concern it is, beginning with the United Nations Organization. It appears that the International Labor Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and other bodies do have fresh contributions to offer on this point in particular. Within the individual states there are ministries or public departments, and also various social institutions set up for this purpose. All of this effectively indicates the importance of the indirect employer, as has been said above, in achieving full respect for the workers' rights, since the rights of the human person are the key element in the whole of the social moral order. 18. The employment issue. When we consider the rights of workers in relation to the indirect employer, that is to say, all the agents at the national and international level that are responsible for the whole orientation of labor policy, we must first direct our attention to a fundamental issue, the question of finding work, or, in other words, the issue of suitable employment for all who are capable of it. The opposite of a just and right situation in this field is unemployment, that is to say, the lack of work for those who are capable of it. It can be a question of general unemployment, or of unemployment in certain sectors of work. The role of the agents included under the title of indirect employer is to act against unemployment, which in all cases is an evil, and which, when it reaches a certain level, can become a real social disaster. It is particularly painful when it especially affects young people, who after appropriate cultural, technical and professional preparation fail to find work, and see their sincere wish to work, and their readiness to take on their own responsibility for the economic and social development of the community sadly frustrated. The obligation to provide unemployment benefits, that is to say, the duty to make suitable grants indispensable for the subsistence of unemployed workers and their families, is a duty springing from the fundamental principle of the moral order in this sphere, namely the principle of the common use of goods, or, to put it in another and still simpler way, the right to life and subsistence. In order to meet the danger of unemployment, and to ensure employment for all, the agents defined here as indirect employer must make provision for overall planning with regard to the different kinds of work by which not only the economic life, but also the cultural life of a given society is shaped. they must also give attention to organizing that work in a correct and rational way. In the final analysis, this overall concern weighs on the shoulders of the state, but it cannot mean one-sided centralization by the public authorities. Instead, what is in question is a just and rational coordination, within the framework of which the initiative of individuals, free groups, and local work centers and complexes must be safeguarded, keeping in mind what has been said above with regard to the subject character of human labor. The fact of the mutual dependence of societies and states, and the need to collaborate in various areas mean that, while preserving the sovereign rights of each society and state, in the field of planning and organizing labor in its own society, action in this important area must also be taken in the dimension of international collaboration by means of the necessary treaties and agreements. Here too, the criterion for these pacts and agreements must more and more be the criterion of human work, considered as a fundamental right of all human beings, work which gives similar rights to all those who work, in such a way that the living standard of the workers in the different societies will less and less show those disturbing differences which are unjust and are apt to provoke even violent reactions. The international organizations have an enormous part to play in this area. They must let themselves be guided by an exact diagnosis of the complex situations and of the influence exercised by natural, historical, civil and other such circumstances. They must also be more highly operative with regard to plans for action jointly decided on, that is to say, they must be more effective in carrying them out. In this direction, it is possible to actuate a plan for universal and proportionate progress by all, in accordance with the guidelines of Paul VI's encyclical Populorum Progressio. It must be stressed that the constitutive element in this progress, and also the most adequate way to verify it in a spirit of justice and peace, which the Church proclaims, and for which she does not cease to pray to the Father, of all individuals and of all peoples, is the continual reappraisal of men's work, both in the aspect of its objective finality and in the aspect of the dignity of the subject of all work, that is to say, man. The progress in question must be made through man, and for man, and it must produce its fruit in man. A test of this progress will be the increasingly mature recognition of the purpose of work, and increasingly universal respect for the rights inherent in work in conformity with the dignity of man, the subject of work. Rational planning and the proper organization of human labor, in keeping with individual societies and states, should also facilitate the discovery of the right proportions between the different kinds of employment: work on the land, in industry, in the various services, white-collar work, and scientific or artistic work, in accordance with the capacities of individuals, and for the common good of each society, and of the whole of mankind. The organization of human life in accordance with the many possibilities of labor should be matched by a suitable system of instruction and education, aimed first of all at developing mature human beings, but also aimed at preparing people specifically for assuming to good advantage an appropriate place in the vast and socially differentiated world of work. As we view the whole human family throughout the world, we cannot fail to be struck by a disconcerting fact of immense proportions: the fact that, while conspicuous natural resources remain unused, there are huge numbers of people who are unemployed or underemployed, and countless multitudes of people suffering from hunger. This is a fact that without any doubt demonstrates that both within the individual political communities and in their relationships on the continental and world level, there is something wrong with the organization of work and employment, precisely at the most critical and socially most important points. 19. Wages and other social benefits. After outlining the important role that concern for providing employment for all workers plays in safeguarding respect for the inalienable rights of man in view of his work, it is worthwhile taking a closer look at these rights, which in the final analysis are formed within the relationship between worker and direct employer. All that has been said above on the subject of the indirect employer is aimed at defining these relationships more exactly by showing the many forms of conditioning within which these relationships are indirectly formed. This consideration does not, however, have a purely descriptive purpose. It is not a brief treatise on economics or politics. It is a matter of highlighting the deontological and moral aspect. The key problem of social ethics in this case is that of just remuneration for work done. In the context of the present, there is no more important way for securing a just relationship between the worker and the employer, and that constituted by remuneration for work, whether the work is done in a system of private ownership of the means of production or in a system where ownership has undergone a certain socialization. The relationship between the employer, first and foremost the direct employer, and the worker is resolved on the basis of the wage, that is, through just remuneration for work done. It should also be noted that the justice of a socio-economic system, and, in each case, its just functioning, deserve in the final analysis to be evaluated by the way in which man's work is properly remunerated in the system. Here we return once more to the first principle of the whole ethical and social order, namely, the principle of the common use of goods, in every system, regardless of the fundamental relationships within it between capital and labor. Wages, that is to say remuneration for work, are still a practical means whereby the vast majority of people can have access to those goods which are intended for common use, both the goods of nature and manufactured goods. Both kinds of goods become accessible to the worker through the wage which he receives as remuneration for his work. Hence, in every case, a just wage is the concrete means of verifying the justice of the whole socio-economic system, and, in any case, of checking that it is functioning justly. It is not the only means of checking, but it is a particularly important one, and, in a sense, the key means. This means of checking concerns above all the family. Just remuneration for the work of an adult who is responsible for a family means remuneration which will suffice for establishing and properly maintaining a family and for providing security for its future. Such remuneration can be given either through what is called a family wage, that is, a single salary given to the head of the family for his work sufficient for the needs of the family, without the other spouse having to take up gainful employment outside the home, or through other social measures such as family allowances or grants to mothers devoting themselves exclusively to their families. These grants should correspond to the actual needs, that is, to the number of dependents, for as long as they are not in a position to assume proper responsibility for their own lives. Experience confirms that there must be a social reevaluation of the mother's role, of the toil connected with it, and of the need that children have for care, love, and affection in order that they may develop into responsible, morally and religiously mature, and psychologically stable persons. It will redound to the credit of society to make it possible for a mother, without inhibiting her freedom, without psychological or practical discrimination, and without penalizing her as compared with other women, to devote herself to taking care of her children and educating them in accordance with their needs, which vary with age. Having to abandon these tasks in order to take up paid work outside the home is wrong from the point of view of the good of society and of the family, when it contradicts or hinders these primary goals of the mission of a mother. 26. In this context, it should be emphasized that, on a more general level, the whole labor process must be organized and adapted in such a way as to respect the requirements of the person and his or her forms of life, above all life in the home, taking into account the individual's age and sex. It is a fact that in many societies women work in nearly every sector of life, but it is fitting that they should be able to fulfill their tasks in accordance with their own nature, without being discriminated against and without being excluded from jobs for which they are capable, but also without lack of respect for their family aspirations and for their specific role in contributing, together with men, to the good of society. The true advancement of women requires that labor should be structured in such a way that women do not have to pay for their advancement by abandoning what is specific to them, and at the expense of the family, in which women as mothers have an irreplaceable role. Besides wages, various social benefits intended to ensure the life and health of workers and their families play a part here. the expenses involved in healthcare, especially in the case of accidents at work, demand that medical assistance should be easily available for workers, and that as far as possible it should be cheap, or even free of charge. Another sector regarding benefits is the sector associated with the right to rest. In the first place, this involves a regular weekly rest comprising at least Sunday, and also a longer period of rest, namely the holiday or vacation taken once a year, or possibly in several shorter periods during the year. A third sector concerns the right to a pension and to insurance for old age, and in case of accidents at work,